listeners. In this weekly program, Marwo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
In the face of escalating U.S. military aggression, Yemen's Ansarullah movement continues to resist, proving that even against the mightiest superpowers, true victory lies in independence and defiance. As the U.S. intensifies its military presence in the region, Yemen's leaders vow to support Gaza and push back against external interference. More details in the following report. The brilliance of Ansarullah, like all resistance movements, lies in its remarkable ability to challenge the world's superpowers, forces that most dare not provoke or defy, and to prove its strength by achieving what can only be defined as true victory, gaining independence and thwarting any external force from imposing its will on Yemen's internal affairs. Currently, Yemen finds itself at the center of an intense confrontation. In mid-March, U.S. President Donald Trump announced heavy airstrikes on the country following the State Department's designation of Ansarullah as a global terrorist organization. This move was seen as fulfilling one of Trump's early promises made upon taking office. The U.S. swiftly deployed aircraft carriers, including the USS Carl Vinson, to the Middle East, intensifying its military presence while prolonging the deployment of the USS Harry S. Truman off Yemen's coast. What drove Trump to take such drastic steps? Firstly, to present himself as stronger than his predecessor, Joe Biden, by showcasing U.S. military might in the region. The presence of two American aircraft carriers and an escalation of military operations sends a clear message. Trump intends to protect Zionist Israel and control vital international trade routes, all while trying to manipulate U.S. public opinion with the image of strength. Secondly, Trump's actions align with the far-right Israeli entity agenda, which seeks to destabilize the region by targeting resistance movements that support the Palestinian cause. Thirdly, there is a strategic calculation to irritate China. The Bab el-Mandeb Strait, a critical trade artery, serves as a conduit for $160 billion U.S. in Chinese exports annually, with 60% of its goods heading to Europe. By controlling this checkpoint, the U.S. aims to apply pressure on Beijing in future negotiations. However, Yemen's response to the U.S. aggression has been nothing short of defiant. Ansarullah's leaders wasted no time announcing that military operations against Israeli entity ships operating in the Arabian and Red Seas would resume. As the U.S. launched its strikes, Yemen's missiles and drones successfully targeted U.S. warships and even hit Tel Aviv, forcing Israeli entity settlers and regime officials into shelters. This is part of a broader effort by Yemen to support Gaza, a mission they pledged to continue until the siege on Gaza is lifted and the U.S. ceases its aggression. Despite the overwhelming military might of the U.S., the war has not shifted Yemen's stance. Instead, it has showcased Ansarullah's strategic ingenuity, using asymmetric tactics and advanced missile technology, such as the Tufan missile, with a range of over 1,600 kilometers to strike targets far beyond Yemen's borders. The U.S. may boast unparalleled military strength, but Yemen's resilience, bolstered by a deeply rooted sense of duty and formidable terrain, has set the stage for what could be a prolonged conflict. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mohammed Al-Zubaydi, Yemeni political commentator. It's a pleasure having you with us, Mr. Mohammed. Now, how has Ansarullah's strategic use of asymmetric warfare and advanced missile technology like the Tufan missile allow it to effectively challenge the very overwhelmingly military power of the United States of America and Zionist Israel? And what impact does this have on maybe the broader resistance movement in the region?
Thank you for having me. In truth, Yemen has redefined the rules of engagement in this battle, Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, through its asymmetric warfare strategy, with surprise being the key element of critical importance. Yemen has also demonstrated exceptional boldness and tactical ingenuity, adopting a distinct strategic approach in confronting this aggression, particularly against its primary adversary, the United States. Another crucial factor has been the low-cost nature of Yemen's operations. It has managed to challenge the U.S. with minimal expenses, using low-cost drones to target warships, naval vessels, and even aircraft carriers, as well as deploying missiles with advanced capabilities that can evade maritime defense radars. However, the most important element is faith. We firmly believe that victory is both a divine craft and a human will. Yemen entered this confrontation fully aware of the high costs and sacrifices, yet it does not fixate on immediate outcomes, but rather on the principles that drive its struggle. These principles are deeply rooted in faith and morality, which is why Yemen does not concern itself with conventional power balances. Instead, it has shattered the status quo of deterrence. Today, even American officials acknowledge their failure to halt Yemen's morally driven and steadfast support for Gaza. This growing American failure is evident in the incapacity of their aircraft carriers. For instance, the USS Harry S. Truman is under constant attack, along with its accompanying naval units, exerting significant pressure on the United States. This pressure is reflected in Trump's recent statement about sending another aircraft carrier, a clear sign of the failure of previous deployments, which have proven ineffective. We recall that in the initial phase of U.S. intervention, Washington dispatched four aircraft carriers, none of which succeeded. Instead, they resorted to a strategy of retreat in the face of Yemen's military tactics and resilience. These developments only strengthen the confidence and resolve of the axis of resistance. The primary objective for both the Zionist entity and the U.S. has been to project an image of victory. Until the very last moment, the Zionists have claimed to have achieved security and altered the strategic landscape, insisting that they have weakened the axis of resistance in specific areas. However, Yemen's intervention has disrupted this narrative, striking deep within the Zionist entity and imposing new equations. One of these new realities is that Ben-Gurion Airport is no longer secure. We have witnessed the intensity of strikes reaching the heart of the Israeli entity, shattering the illusion of security. Today, security is unattainable within the Zionist entity. Tel Aviv is no longer safe, and Ben-Gurion Airport is no longer a reliable hub for air travel. We have also seen major international airlines reconsidering their flights to Tel Aviv. These significant shifts will undoubtedly serve as a source of strength and momentum for the axis of resistance moving forward.
Well, there's a very important question that I want to ask here, Mr. Mohammed. While the U.S. is focused on protecting Zionist Israel and controlling key maritime trade routes through the Bab al-Mandeb and the Red Sea, how long can Yemen continue to resist under these constant U.S. airstrikes to protect its territory and to remain loyal to the Palestinian cause?
Until the very last breath, I assure you, Yemen has entered this battle with unwavering conviction in the sanctity and significance of its stance. It has not engaged arbitrarily or recklessly, as some claim. This is not a Yemeni gamble or an uncalculated adventure. On the contrary, Yemen fully comprehends the magnitude of the sacrifices required and is prepared to endure them at every level. Yemen understands that failing to take a firm and escalating position at this stage would be a grave mistake. As Sayyid Abdul Malik Badruddin al-Houthi emphasized in his recent speech, this phase demands the highest levels of escalation. He made it clear that Yemen will escalate further because the moment calls for it, whether in response to the Zionist entity's renewed aggression on Gaza or the arrogant language of American threats against Yemen. Trump has spoken of bringing hell upon Yemen, of deploying deadly and crushing force, but Yemen remains steadfast, fully aware of the weight of its stance and the sacred duty it upholds. This awareness is rooted in an unshakable faith. Sayyid al-Houthi has previously stated that if the Americans truly understood the depth of Yemen's faith-driven position, they would alter their own strategy. It is this faith that binds Yemen to its commitment, to remain resolute, to stand firm. The facts on the ground and the historical record confirm Yemen's unwavering stance, one that will not waver. Yemen will continue to stand with Gaza. It will never accept the isolation of Gaza, nor will it allow any faction of the axis of resistance to stand alone. The same was true in Lebanon. Yemen made it clear, you are not alone. Whether it is Hezbollah or the Lebanese people, they are not alone. Yemen will remain steadfast in this struggle until its very last breath. We fully recognize the costs and the sacrifices will be immense, yet our trust in Allah remains absolute. This unwavering faith, rooted in divine consciousness and Quranic awareness, fortifies our resolve and affirms that Yemen will stay on this path until the very end, God willing. We firmly believe in one of the inevitable promises outlined in the Quran, the certainty of victory over these enemies, by the will of Allah Almighty.
Well, President Trump has consistently accused Ansarullah of being Iranian proxies, warning that Iran will be his next target. Why is the U.S. so insistent on linking Yemen to Iran in the same way it targets Hezbollah in Lebanon? And how would Ansarullah react if the U.S. actually and Zionist Israel decide to escalate their aggression and target Iran?
From the very beginning, the United States has sought to sever the Islamic Republic of Iran as the spearhead of the axis of resistance from the peoples and forces within this alliance. If you recall, One of the key American conditions in the previous Iranian nuclear deal was for Iran completely detach itself from the Axis. Iran, however, categorically rejected this demand. Now, as discussions about a potential new nuclear agreement resurface, there is no doubt that the United States is once again pushing for this condition. Yet, the Islamic Republic remains firm in its refusal, viewing its moral, ethical, and ideological commitment to the Axis as paramount, not as a matter of Iranian national interest alone, but as a commitment to the entire Ummah. From Yemen's perspective, there is nothing to be ashamed of in this relationship. On the contrary, we take pride in it. By the grace of Allah, we openly declare that our ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran are a source of honor. We are aligned with the spearhead of global support for the oppressed, the backbone of resistance against American and Zionist hegemony, and all forces of arrogance. Trump frequently repeats the claim that every bullet fired in Yemen is an Iranian bullet. This serves two purposes. First, it is an attempt to diminish Yemen's growing military power and strategic effectiveness, something that deeply unsettles both the United States and the Zionist entity. Second, it lays the groundwork for a potential future justification for aggression against Iran. Recently, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei made a critical point, particularly directed at the Americans, when he stated that describing the forces and nations of the Axis as mere pawns or proxies of Iran is a strategic miscalculation. And indeed, this assessment is entirely accurate. Viewing Yemen as nothing more than an extension of Iran is a grave strategic mistake. Yemen's struggle is driven by the will of its own people, independent, sovereign, and unwavering in its decisions. We are now in a critical phase, one defined by the erosion of American hegemony. The United States is making a monumental strategic mistake by attempting to downplay Yemen's rising power, a power that has shattered the illusion of American invincibility, not just on land, but in the seas as well. The mere presence of American military forces in the region has become a liability, as Yemen's relentless strikes on aircraft carriers and naval assets continue to impose heavy costs. Thus, we stand at the threshold of a new era, an era marked by the dismantling of American dominance. And as Washington scrambles for an exit, it clings to the tired narrative of Iranian proxies and pawns. But as Sayyid Khamenei rightfully pointed out, this is nothing more than a strategic blunder of historic proportions.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammed Al-Zubaydi, political commentator, for joining us to talk about these pressing matters right here. Ladies and gents, please do follow us to get more updates about the region of West Asia right here on the Middle East Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
Quran Quest on Iran Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Quran Quest on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sayyid Salman Naqavi, my guest speaker, a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid, and welcome to the program.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you back in the studio, shedding light on my Quranic questions, especially this episode that we are going to actually pick up where we left off discussing some of the questions regarding Surah Al-Takfir and this holy month of Ramadan. I asked the question, and unfortunately, the previous episode we ran, out of time. So we'd like to, actually talk about that and complete somehow that answer. But before we move on, let's listen to a few verses of this great chapter of the Noble Quran, Surah Al-Takfir, and then we get back and continue our program, Quran Quest, on RIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeeb. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Idha ash-shamsu kuwirat.
When the sun is wrapped up in darkness, And when the stars fall dispersing, and when the mountains are removed.
Welcome back to the program Quran Quest on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speaker, Sayyed Salman Naghavi, a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University. We are still on the discussion of or discussing this great chapter of the Quran, Surah At-Takfir. We talked about a couple of issues, in fact, in the last two episodes where we started this chapter and the discussion regarding it. We talked about where or the origin of the name of this takbir, where it comes from, the initial verse, obviously. And we also talked about the reason of revelation. And we also, in the last episode, talked about, the difference between the scientific facts and investigation and inquiry, and also religious perspective and God's knowledge of the unseen. Sayyed, I asked you a question regarding, in fact, what do we say or how do we apply scientific facts to, let's say, religious realm or somehow metaphysical, let's say, issues. And also, I would like to add something regarding Kant's critique of pure reason, because I think to some extent he was right when he talked about some realms or some, let's say, domains of knowledge that goes beyond somehow or is not limited, let's say, to scientific investigation, because these or the body of the knowledge that we get from God, like through the Holy Scriptures, including our Quran, you know, it talks about some aspects that do not lend themselves easily to some kind of physical laws or physical investigation. Don't you agree?
Yes, that's true. When the Quran is talking about some very sublime meanings of a transcendental nature, the existence of God Himself, maybe, or in the existence of the angels, for example, we're talking about realms which the physical senses and physical perception cannot comprehend at all. Mm-hmm. The sensory, it does not fall in the realm of physical happenings that can be, because the scope of scientific research and whatever is investigation is carried out is within the scope of physical and material corporeal existence.
Mm-hmm.
So some things which are beyond that,
yes.
Science cannot, indulge in that at all.
Yes.
But when it is talking about physical happenings, the Quran, for example, when we talk about the verses that we are going to engage in, in the Surah At-Takwir, when we talk about is Ashamsu Kubwirat,
yes,
the winding up of the sun, the Takwir is from Kubwirat,
yes,
the infinite form of the Kubwirat,
yes,
is Takwir, the Master,
yes,
the infinite form
of
Kubwirat. So he's talking about a physical thing. It's
yes.
talking about a physical happening that will be happening in the future. So the science can or cannot predict what's happening. But what will happen, maybe we may be able to explain in scientific terms. Because when it talks about the winding up of the sun.
Yes.
Or in sometimes Kubwirat is also, it means the darkening of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Becomes dark, or its light extinguishes.
Yes.
So maybe scientifically we can explain what it means, but will it happen? Will science be able to predict when it's going to happen? No, we're not. We can't say for sure. We can't say that at all. Maybe in the future, scientific study and investigation takes us to that level.
Yes.
But here, when we shall discuss these, the first part, which is beginning with Iza. in Arabic. This is a device which is used for a conditional statement, a proposition which is conditional, is contingent. It has two parts. One part is the condition, and the second part is that
result.
Is the result which is going to happen, take place. And the first part, the idha, also is not just the happening of something. It is the happening of something in a, all of a sudden. It's called mufajat. It's going to happen all of a sudden without any, you know, anyone being able to
predict it.
So basically, idha kuwirat, when the sun will be wound up, or it will darken out, it will be extinguished, or whatever, it is going to happen all of a sudden. And it's the passive word is being, the form is being used, and also the past tense is being used. Idha kuwirat. It would have happened, maybe. But it's in the, it's not translated to be it would have happened, or it happened in the in the past. It is, it will happen, it shall happen, it shall come about.
Yes.
And the past tense is used because it wants to say that it is something which is taken for sure, that it will consider it to be happening as it happened, as it ever happened in the past.
Yes.
It's something which will come about in any case.
I have a question.
So science cannot, you know, predict that.
Thank you very much.
But still, we can't say everything what is contained in the Quran, and is to when the Quran is talking about physical entities and the celestial bodies, it is within the realm of science to be, you know, be able to explain that.
The first part, at least.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
In the same way, it's not just science. I mean, a lot of things, if you know about them, apart from science, if you know about philosophy, then you can explain many things which are mentioned in the Quran in the philosophical terms.
Exactly. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Quran Quest, on RIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
You are listening to Quran Quest on Iran Radio.
Welcome back to the program Quran Quest on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad Hossein, this program, and Sayyid Salman Naghavi, my guest speaker, a faculty member of Al Mustafa University. We are talking about or discussing Surah Al-Takwir, especially the first verse, that's Shamsu Kuvrat, when the sun is wound up. Sayyid, you said that, in fact, you know, and you also mentioned that some of these happenings could be counted for, actually, by science, right? Based on the facts that we get from, for example, the previous darkening of the stars and the black holes and everything that happened to, you know, the transient nature of the physical nature, basically. You mentioned, in fact, something, you know, regarding the scientific prediction based on the investigation, the empirical investigation they have. I wanted to ask you a question, a very short question there. Even if science would be able actually to predict something, like it would happen, for example, some special events would happen. They say most of the scientists especially, or even philosophers, talked about this problem with scientific prediction, that they say they could only come up with the predictions. There is no room in science for purpose. They don't talk about the purpose. They don't believe that there is a purpose for this, or there is a reason for this, that it, for example, should happen or should not happen. They only deal with the scientific facts and figures.
Yes, so it's not within the realm of science at all to discover what the purpose is behind these happenings, maybe. They're just looking for the causes, how it happened. Why is not the consideration of science? Why did it happen?
Exactly.
How did it happen? What were the sequence of events that led to that to happen? That's basically the ambit of science.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why did the, what is the purpose behind it? Of course, they say they go beyond their boundaries, and they say because we don't find any purpose, therefore it has no purpose. They can't say that. For example, when you talk about you're talking about zakat. For example, Islam says that you have to give zakat.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the purpose for that? The helping the needy people. So economics tells us needy people, what do we mean by a person in need?
Mm-hmm.
Economics may help us to understand, is he living within below the poverty line? But the decision to give it to him is not the field of economics to say.
Mm-hmm.
So it's religion which is going to say, or it's ethics which is going to give you that.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, so we have to make the boundaries between the various subjects and disciplines which we have. The discipline, scientific discipline, is basically talking about the discovering what is happening in the physical realm, and it is trying to discover how it happened. Why it happened is not within that scope at all. Though the logical positivists would try to say this, yes, we have, because we don't find anything beyond this physical world, therefore it does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to explain everything in physical terms, especially when it comes to the brain and the mind and the issue of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So the debate goes on and on.
Yes.
So therefore, this holy surah that we're going to talk about is not talking about these issues. There's a lot of other holy verses where you can expand upon that.
Yes, inshallah.
But still, it is even, Quran is, on the other hand, motivating us as human beings to go out and find.
And discover.
And discover. And even in the empirical way,
mm-hmm.
it's not negating empirical way. When it says, أَفَلَا يَنْظُرُونَ إِلَى الْإِبْلِ كَيْفَ خُلِقَتْ, it's talking about the empirical way of observing things.
Or when God swears by the moon and the sun.
Yes.
Quite physical, natural objects.
No, I'm talking about
heavenly objects.
The scientific inquiry, the way how to go about the investigation of using and employing the inductive way of reasoning.
Thank you very much, Sayyid. That was Salman Naghavi, a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University, my guest speaker, discussing with me about chapter Takfir or Surah Al-Takfir. And inshallah, in the upcoming episodes, we continue and move along with the different verses of this chapter. And because we are still in Ramadan, and of course, despite the fact that we are in the last days of Ramadan, it's a very good opportunity for me to ask you earnestly to pray for us. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Quran Quest, the program that answers your Quranic questions.
Pieces of bread from me, and your soul will never be broken. And if I am your haven, you will never be homeless. One whose cloak is me will never be naked. And one whose resort is me will never be destitute. God is above all powers. IRIB English Radio.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from Arab English Radio. This is Zainab Musavi, and what we do in this program is to listen to certain viewpoints of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, who was the great founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and then try to shed light and explain some precious points in their view. Well, about Quds Day, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, Quds Day is a day of unity for the Muslim community. It is a day to express our support for the oppressed Palestinian people and to proclaim our opposition to the usurpers. The quotation from Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi regarding Quds Day encapsulates a fundamental tenet of Shia Islam: the emphasis on justice, resistance against oppression, and solidarity with the oppressed. Quds Day, established by Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi in 1979, serves a global reminder for Muslims to unite in support of the Palestinian struggle against occupation. From a Shia perspective, the concept of justice is deeply rooted in the teachings of the Quran and the sayings of the Prophet ﷺ and the infallible Imams. One relevant verse is Surah Al-Ma'idah, verse number 8, which emphasizes standing firmly for justice. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim, O you who have believed, be persistently standing firm in justice, witnesses in justice. This verse underscores the obligation to advocate for the oppressed and resist tyranny, aligning with Imam Khomeini's call for solidarity with the Palestinian people. Moreover, the principle of enjoining good and forbidding evil, that is, Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy anil Munkar, a crucial aspect in Shia, compels Muslims to confront injustice. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam is quoted as saying, the best struggle or jihad is the word of justice before an oppressive ruler. This highlights the importance of vocal opposition to tyranny as embodied in the plight of Palestinians. In essence, Imam Khomeini's proclamation and Quds Day reflects a broader Shia commitment to justice and to support for the oppressed, resonating with the teachings of the Holy Book of Quran and the prophetic tradition that advocates for the rights of all marginalized communities. Okay, well, dear listeners, that was the time we had for this episode of Spring of the Truth. For ending, let me just recite the sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi about the Quds Day once more. He said, Quds Day is a day of unity for the Muslim community. It is a day to express our support for the oppressed Palestinian people and to proclaim our opposition to the usurpers. Thank you very much. Until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say.
The
was Spring of Truth, a selection of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints.
April 10th, 2024, Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, attended Eid al-Fitr prayer. The prayer is the most important religious aid of Muslims after a month of fasting. Ayatollah Khamenei talked about the certainty of punishing the Israeli regime. All military experts admitted that the Iranian leader's warning will be carried out. There were many speculations regarding how it would be fulfilled. Iran would soon show the world its might. It all happened at a time when the U.S. martyred the Iranian national hero and top anti-terrorist command. Ayatollah Khamenei stated, Israel's attack on Iran's embassy in Damascus was tantamount to an attack on Iranian territory. This declaration prompted some officials in the Israeli ruling party to deny any involvement in the attack. Analysts believe Iran would harm the interests of the Israeli regime through its allies and scattered battles. Others believe that Iran might attack one of Israel's diplomatic centers, potentially choosing a weaker country in the region like Jordan. Consequently, Israel began evacuating its diplomatic missions, which were considered possible targets. The U.S. had a different perspective. It believed Iran was deliberately positioning missiles in view of spy satellites to send a message to hostile countries that the attack will originate from the Islamic Republic's territory. If this speculation was accurate, how severe could Iran's attack be? Since the Second Arab-Israeli War, no country had targeted the Israeli regime. When Iraq, under Saddam, faced the first U.S. attack in 1990, it fired 11 missiles at Israel, all of which were thwarted. Most of Yemen's cruise missiles were also intercepted over the last 5 months.
We cannot say for certain what these missiles and drones were targeting, but they were launched from Yemen, heading north along the Red Sea, potentially towards targets in.
Now, Iran was considering attacking targets 2,000 kilometers beyond its borders. But was this feasible, and what would be the retaliation from Israel? Turkey, Iran's northwestern neighbor, not only produces and owns anti-ballistic and anti-cruise defense systems, but also has special NATO systems. Former U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Victoria Nuland stated that Turkey should have the highest defense capabilities. This means Iran had to deal with a defense system in the northwest. To the west, Iran is bordered by Iraq, which was occupied by the United States. On January 20, 2020, Iran destroyed large Ain al-Assad base with missiles in response to the assassination of Major General Qasem Soleimani, the commander of Iran's Quds Force.
Well, words can't even describe the amount of energy that is released by these missiles.
Rocket launches were conducted after Iraqi authorities were given a heads up 20 minutes before the firing, and likely the U.S. was also informed of the attack, but no defensive move was made against the missiles. 1 month later, on March 30, 2020, BBC Farsi reported the U.S. Army has deployed the Patriot anti-missile system in some bases in Iraq to protect its forces from possible attacks by Iran and its allies. Agence France-Presse also reported on March 30th, quoting anonymous sources, that one of the systems was sent to Ain al-Assad base in western Iraq last week and is currently being prepared. Thus, the Patriot systems based in Iraq will be the first defense barrier against Iran. Moreover, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have had open relationships with Israel for some time. Even when Yemen disrupted the transfer of goods from the Red Sea to Israel, the UAE and Saudi Arabia provided a free land route for goods to Jordan and from Jordan to Israeli-occupied territories. NATO's military capability should also be considered. Besides the U.S. and certain Arab states along the Persian Gulf, France and the U.K. would now also be part of the system defending Israel. Meanwhile, Israel uses a wide range of systems to counter attacks, from ballistic missiles with trajectories carrying them high into the atmosphere to cruise missiles and surface-to-surface rockets. Israel's Iron Dome system has often made headlines since the regime's military operation in Gaza in response to the Hamas-led operation of the 7th of October. But can this system, which has not been tested against any real or serious attack, be Israel's last layer of defense? At the highest level of defense, Israel uses the Arrow 1 and Arrow 2 anti-missile systems, cutting-edge technology from the U.S. The radar consists of four components: the Arrow interceptor missile, the Green Pine radar, Communication Control Command Center, and Launch Control Center. The system also uses the American Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, system and is movable. The radar can detect 30 targets at very high altitudes while traveling over 9 times the speed of sound. They claim that the newer version of the system can track ballistic missiles up to a range of 600 kilometers. The system calculates the ballistic trajectory of launched missiles and destroys them when they are on its path. The Arrow intercepts missiles in the uppermost layer of the atmosphere or beyond to prevent the spread of chemical or nuclear materials over occupied territories. On October 31, 2023, Israel claimed to have destroyed Yemen's long-range ballistic missile, and on November 9, Arrow 3, Israel's most advanced anti-missile system, reportedly intercepted a Yemeni medium-range missile near the port of Eilat. Each Arrow system contains 2 to 8 missiles and takes an hour to reload. At a lower layer is a Davis Sling missile system designed to counter missiles with a range of 70 to 300 kilometers, including Hezbollah's Katyushas, Qassam rockets, and Iran's tactical missiles. The system cost about $2 billion funded by American taxpayers to protect Israel. David Sling is designed to intercept and destroy targets at altitudes ranging from several meters to 15 kilometers above the ground, even if the targets travel at speeds up to 7 times the speed of sound. The radar range of David Sling exceeds 470 kilometers. The system contains 12 missiles and is capable of engaging ballistic missiles. Each Davis-Sling missile costs $1 million and functions by directly hitting the attacking missile. In the final stage, there's the Iron Dome. Each rocket costs $50 million and each missile costs $20,000. The Iron Dome is designed to shoot down targets such as mortars and rockets, which are often fired from Lebanon and Gaza. It is supposed to be most useful for protecting the cities near Gaza, as a large number of low-cost rockets are launched from the Gaza side. There are also THAAD and Patriot systems between Iran and occupied territories. THAAD combines features of all other systems and can engage targets at all altitudes. It is the exclusive interceptor for the United States and NATO. THAAD can intercept any target up to a range of 1,000 kilometers. The radar has two search modes, forward base and terminal base. In forward mode, the base is installed near the borders of the hostile country to estimate the direction of the missiles immediately after they are fired. A radar of this type has been installed in Turkey, with another one in the occupied territories. In base mode, the radar is responsible for detecting and guiding anti-missile systems up to a range of 1,000 kilometers. When THAAD is linked with a satellite, its range increases significantly. Furthermore, the Patriot system is located between Iran and Israel. The optimized Patriot has a missile with a smaller warhead that can reach higher altitudes, about 20 kilometers. The Patriot system forms a large dome next to THAAD, which has a range of 200 kilometers. Before the first Persian Gulf War, THAAD and the Patriot systems had not been tested on the ground. When Saddam Hussein started using Al-Hussein and Al-Abbas ballistic missiles, then U.S. President George Bush claimed they had intercepted 39 of the 40 missiles fired. However, on February 25, 1991, one of these missiles hit the Dahran base in Saudi Arabia, killing 28 U.S. soldiers. The U.S. president and military were concealing a secret. The Patriot system was supposed to distinguish whether a missile was fired at a sensitive target or towards the desert, and would not fire it if there was no danger. This system wasn't 100% effective, and as a result, only 25 of the 88 missiles fired by Iraq were intercepted. The Patriot system did not engage the rest. After the 1991 invasion, the United Nations banned Iraq from continuing its long-range missile program. However, in 2003, former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein secretly decided to build a missile with a range of 150 kilometers. That year, he acquired two tactical missiles. Previously, Iraq used Scud missiles, which were modified into Al-Hussein and Al-Abbas missiles by combining two Scuds. The Al-Abbas missile was intended to have a range of 1,000 kilometers, but failed, and the project was abandoned after the first Persian Gulf War. In 2003, the new missiles did not work, and the U.S. destroyed all of them after occupying Iraq. Iraq then built the Al-Samud missile, but it did not achieve satisfactory results. These were low-quality rockets intended to be combined with a few remaining rockets from the war. The Patriot system was the most successful among them, meaning Iran had to face the most complex defense systems in history. This also included air-launched missiles from fighter jets. What did Iran possess in order to overcome this size of defense system? It had completed the reverse engineering of the Scud missiles imported from Libya and developed the Shahab-1 missile with a range of about 300 kilometers. Military sources claimed Iran handed over its Shahab arsenal to Oman, Syria, and Hezbollah after achieving longer-range missiles. In the early 90s, Iran developed the Shahab-2 missile, similar to the Russian Scud-C. Soon after, Iran created the Shahab-3 missile. With a range of 2,100 kilometers, it can hit targets with over 1 ton of explosives. The Shahab 3 was considered Iran's most important deterrent against Israel's attacks in the 1990s. The most important tests of the Shahab were conducted in the desert of Qom, central Iran. In November 2001, Iran equipped its missiles with cluster warheads. On November 7, 2003, the Washington Post reported that the Islamic Republic of Iran had developed a missile named Shahab 4, but had halted its production. The missile, capable of reaching Europe with a non-nuclear warhead, could pose a threat to Israel if equipped with a heavier weapon. The regime's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, claimed that Iran has two other versions of the Shahab missile, namely the Shahab 5 and the Shahab 6, which have a range of more than 15,000 kilometers and are capable of striking any point on the planet. However, Iran has never commented on these claims. Iran has missiles called the Ghadr-F and the Ghadr-H. These missiles can be prepared for firing in less than 30 minutes and are considered tactical weapons with a range of 1,650 kilometers. Some categorize these missiles as hypersonic. Iran has also designed a missile named the Qiyam without wingtips, giving it extremely high radar evasion capability. Arming the Qiyam for firing takes only 20 minutes. Sejid is a different type of Iranian missile with a two-stage engine that runs on solid fuel. It is a mid-range missile with an operating range of 1,900 kilometers. Sejid can cover the distance from Natanz, which Israel aspires to hit, to Tel Aviv in less than 7 minutes. The Sejid 2 has a wingtip on the cap, significantly increasing its accuracy to below 50 meters. The Sejid 2 is guided through a combination of inertia, cap, and accurate gyroscopes with GPS positioning. Iran's missile experience, which began with Scud missiles, gradually led to the development of the Imad precision strike missiles. Imad has a range of 1,700 kilometers and features a warhead with wingtips, allowing Iranian users to guide it until the moment of impact. Unlike ballistic missiles, which hit targets like a stone after the warhead engine shuts off, Imad dives towards the target like a guided projectile. On February 13, 2024, Iran conducted a different experiment. The Aerospace Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps fired a series of Imad and Ghadr-F missiles with guided warheads at a specific target. The Palm Achim Air Base, the main location where Israel's F-35 fighter jets are kept. The Israeli Prime Minister had threatened Iran militarily at this base with the American F-35 fighter behind him. The Palm Achim base is about 15 kilometers long. Iran simulated the plane hangar map for the test. The impact points were recorded by remote control cameras known as GoPro. Warheads of the missiles were non-explosive to accurately calculate the point of impact. After traveling about 1,500 kilometers, the Imad missiles hit the simulation targets and tents with high accuracy of 4 meters. This is a scene of the warhead hitting without a missile and the volume of dust rising due to the impact of the warhead. If the missiles were equipped with their famous high explosive warheads, a hell of fire would form at the impact site. In 2007, Iran tested a missile named Ashura. Iran's defense minister stated that the missile had an operational range of 2,000 kilometers. Uzi Rubin, the former head of Israel's missile department, reacted by saying, "If the information about this missile is correct, its construction is an important milestone in Iran's missile program." Ashura uses solid fuel, which greatly reduces the possibility of tracking the rocket launcher by satellites and aerial radars, and allows the missile to be transferred from one point to another. The military official from the Israeli regime also stated that the missile can hide and its preparation for launch does not require much time. Iran produced the Kheibar and Khorramshahr series of missiles. The accuracy of these missiles is less than 10 meters, and at a range of 2,000 kilometers, their accuracy is below 30 meters. The guidance and control system operates in the middle phase of the flight, with guidance occurring outside the Earth's atmosphere. Upon leaving the atmosphere, missile's main engine shuts off when the fuel runs out and its warhead separates. Four small control motors and four small guidance motors outside the atmosphere guide the warhead. This missile can change and correct its direction outside the atmosphere, making it very difficult to intercept by anti-ballistic missile defense systems. As it moves towards the target, the missile rotates and its warhead rains down on the target, breaking into 80 smaller rockets near the target. This missile poses a serious threat to Israel as it covers all parts of the occupied territories. Iran's missile power is based on the Scud missiles it acquired at the beginning of the Iran-Iraq War. Through reverse engineering, Iran developed its own technology. But are these few missiles all Iran can muster to fight the Israeli regime? Facing Iran is the entire NATO defense system, and an attack on Israel requires special equipment. Does Iran have what it takes?
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarsi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll discuss some of the contents of chapter Naml, the 27th chapter of the Holy Quran, as well as some of the commentary points of the verses. Dear listeners, we have reached
69th and 70th verses of Surah An-Naml. Let's listen to these two verses.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.